pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. This is a public meeting of the mayor and council of the township of Clinton, county of Hunterdon, state of New Jersey. Adequate notice of this meeting has been given in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and that the notice of an agenda for this meeting was posted on the bulletin boards in the municipal building and faxed to the Hunterdon County Democrat, the Express Times, the Courier News, the Hunterdon Review, and the Star Ledger in one breath. Could you call the roll?
Yes, here.
Councilman
Jackson
now?
Here.
Councilman White?
Here.
Present.
Here. Thank you. First item would be the approval of meeting minutes and regular session from May 9. Are there any comments or edits, typos?
Motion.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye. I'll say aye.
Okay.
I'm just checking to make sure which ones I can vote on.
Oh, I wasn't. Oh, that's right. Okay. Thank you. Abstain.
Carl will remind you.
Next item is the regular session meeting minutes from May 23rd, 2018. Again, any questions, comments, edits?
I'll make a motion.
I abstain.
I'll second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed or abstain?
I abstain.
Okay. Amy and Brian?
Abstain.
Okay. And then we had the special session budget meeting from June 7th. And those meeting minutes are next.
I'll move those.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Abstaining or opposed? Thank you. And lastly, boy, Carla, you caught up. The regular session meeting minutes from June 13.
Yep.
Okay.
I'll make a motion.
I'll second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed or abstain?
Abstain.
Thank you. All right, now we're down to the consent agenda, which is which are rather routine items, and they need to be voted upon all at once. And typical thing, release of escrows, authorizing a refund of overpayment of taxes, authorizing a premium refund, and cancellation of taxes due to a veteran's disability. Any comments, concerns?
I have none.
Motion.
Second.
Carla?
Councilwoman Switley?
Yes.
Councilman Kupchinowski?
Yes.
Councilman
Yes.
Council President McTiernan?
Yes.
Mayor Higgins?
Yes. Okay, now we have a work session. And for those of you that have looked at the agenda, we have a busy, busy agenda this evening. We've got, six ordinances up. So I would ask that we try to get this bounded by about a half hour, if that's good. Okay. And Rich, would you like to come up and do the introductions? Rich Shaw is the chair of our Open Space Committee. And I would just mention that the idea of hunting deer on our open space was brought up, gosh, at least 2 years ago at Open Space, maybe three if I remember. Bill Honachevsky's dad actually brought it up. And, from a personal perspective, we had a snowstorm and a windstorm which knocked down a bunch of trees in my neighborhood. It's a cluster development that has about 125 acres of common land. Went out in the woods with my chainsaw to get some downed trees, and I mean, I could see forever. The lack of understory was startling. And then Rich and I began discussions, and he began discussions with other folks. So without further ado.
Yeah, so Rich Shaw, 2 Pine Tree Drive. And as Mayor Higgins said, I'm the head of the Open Space Committee. And what I'm talking here, there's an environmental commission in town as well. And I think the two commissions have kind of, you know, been talking about this, and Mayor Higgins, I think you kind of laid out quite a bit of it. The primary thing we're concerned about, certainly from an environmental commission and open space, is when we walk around. We're not maybe specialists in this area, but we can see just horrendous deterioration of the forest, and then we ask around from experts what that's for. You know, why is it that we don't have any young trees except for autumn or Russian olives and other invasives growing in, and when a tree does fall, there's nothing there to take its place. And so as time is going on, we can see it on the open space as well as on private properties. The forest is just going down. And so how do you turn that around? Well, and also, so it turns out that the experts think the main culprit is white-tailed deer, and there is an overconcentration of that, and they need to get that population in control. And this has been looked at, it's been attempted in any number of townships, and it's interesting that so many people have tried this and they don't really have success. But that doesn't mean we cannot put together a program, and we have a lot of expertise and learnings from attempts that have been made in the past. And we have here tonight two people, Cindy Kunstner from the State Department of Environmental Protection came to help out with any questions, and Professor Jay Kelly is, I would say, a specialist in this area and is at Raritan Valley Community College and has graciously offered to come over. And he's going to give a presentation on sort of what is the state, some stuff customized to Clinton Township, and then respond to questions. And as you say, we have limited time. So with that, I'll maybe turn this over to you, Jay.
Thank you, Rich, and welcome, Professor.
Hello. I heard there's no projector in the room. I'm giving this as a slideshow for people to see. So I printed up as many copies as I could. 7 members of the committee.
Thank you.
So I'll provide a color version of this PDF so you can see some of the details in it. Electronically later on. I also made copies for the public. I didn't know how many people were coming, so I printed 15. If some of you could share, I think that'd probably get the most of the group. Would you like a copy up front, too?
I'll have some. Okay, one.
Sure.
I'll share
yours. So I have a PhD in ecology from Rutgers University, and I've been studying biology and conservation of local plant and animal species for over 20 years in New Jersey. I'm associate professor of biology and environmental science at Raritan Valley Community College, and I've been conducting a study on the effects of deer and invasive plant species on our local forests and other ecosystems for the past 5 years. And my interest in this are in some ways similar to what many other people in this state have, being concerned about being a gardener at home and watching deer eating my landscaping, hitting deer 3 times with my car in the past 10 years. There's obviously an abundance of deer in the landscape. But equally or more concerning for me as a conservation biologist was seeing the effects the deer were having across the landscapes of New Jersey. I study rare plant species populations for the state government, and it's been just apparent to me, glaring to me for working here in the past 20 years, how our forests and other ecosystems are just being decimated by deer and invasive plant species in particular. And there are many things that are impacting our forests. There's acid rain, there's climate change, invasive pests and diseases. But in the short term, the things that are having the most severe impact in the present that I could identify were deer and invasive plants. And so we endeavored to conduct this study, which started in partnership with New Jersey Audubon Society, and we were funded by the National Science Foundation. And our goal was to document the extent to which these two factors were impacting forests and to provide this information to local communities and other groups so that they can understand the severity of the problem and also understand what options were available to help confront it. And so I'll just try to walk through this presentation on paper as best I can. But just for perspective on the second page here, the phenomenon that we're seeing in New Jersey of the escalating deer populations is not limited to this state. It's actually a range-wide phenomenon that white-tailed deer are exhibiting. And it's been happening approximately for the past 40 or 50 years. The reasons are complicated for it, but they go back to really the 1800s, when we exterminated cougars and wolves from the landscape really throughout the eastern states. We also removed Native Americans. But we also had commercial hunting taking place. And so by the end of the 1800s, deer were actually nearly extinct and throughout most of their range. And then federal law brought commercial hunting of deer to an end. And with the end of the hunting and the loss of predators, it really set the stage for the deer population to recover and then to go beyond its natural historic boundaries. And two other factors fell into place in the past 50 to 100 years since then. We have warming winters that in many years are no longer cold enough to kill deer in large numbers, and that was always historically a factor as well. And more recently, and especially in this part of the country, we have suburban development, which does a number of things that benefit deer. One, when you have suburban development, it's very difficult to hunt deer in those locations, so it creates refuges for deer. But deer are also an edge species. They like to take cover during the day, which the woods provide, and then they come out at night into the surrounding landscapes, whether it's farm fields or your yards and gardens, to feed. And so by fragmenting forests with our developments, we have also created the ideal habitat for deer to supplement their populations with additional food resources and also to further inhibit hunting and other factors that could bring their populations down. And so it's a natural effect of how we've changed the landscape that the deer populations have risen in the way that they have really throughout their range, with the greatest numbers being reported in the Northeast Corridor from Boston to D.C. So the next slide here. At the local level, biologists estimate that deer were approximately 10 per square mile is the natural background density. And we know this for a variety of reasons, but one of the simple indicators of that is that when you get more than 10 deer per square mile, you start to see particular plant species disappearing from forests and other habitats, the things that the deer like to eat the most, like lilies and trillium, orchids of certain kinds. They begin to just disappear because there are too many deer for them to be supported. When you get more than 20 deer per square mile, you start to see broad impacts in forests in particular with a loss of the understory in general. So shrubs will disappear, young trees and seedlings and saplings will disappear as well. And so the natural background density, just as a benchmark for perspective, is 10 deer per square mile. And in different parts of New Jersey, the state government estimates that we have between 13 and 76 deer per square mile on average, with this part of the state having the highest 76. But it's important to note that those numbers from the state government are actually just estimates based on hunting statistics. So that's really an estimate of the hunted population. And since much of central New Jersey is not actually hunted because it's so difficult to hunt in the suburbs, local numbers here are actually quite a bit higher in many places. We've been doing studies for 5 years now in New Jersey, and other local groups have as well. And it's quite common to see deer populations at over 100 per square mile. We've documented 200 on our campus in Branchburg. Duke Farms had 380 per square mile prior to their hunting and deer exposure program. So the numbers are just entirely out of balance and unsustainable for not just the plant species and the forests to be healthy, but for all the other species that are depending upon it. So if 10 is what we need for the ecosystem to be in balance, you can imagine what 300 per square mile is going to mean for everything else in the ecosystem. And so the forest, the image on the left here on this slide shows what a healthy forest should look like with all the layers present, from the herb layer on the forest floor, seedlings, saplings, shrubs, and trees growing in the understory. But a typical forest in central Jersey looks like one of the two images on the right, where there's either a completely barren understory and nothing growing there, or in that vacuum that the deer have created, you find invasive plant species filling those niches. And so on the right there, the picture from Bernardsville, you can see 100% Japanese barberry in the understory, and there's some deer in the image, which are probably a little difficult to see right now. And again, this translates into effects on other species that depend upon the forest as well. So this slide here that I'm looking at is from a Rutgers study that was conducted in Millstone at Hutchison Memorial Forest. These were some bird biologists who found that they studied breeding bird populations in the forest going back into the 1980s and found that the species that nest up in the canopy have been doing fine. Their populations are not declining. The species in the mid-canopy levels that depend on large shrubs and mid- or small-sized trees are kind of in between. Many of them are declining. Some are still holding their own. But the bird species that nest in the shrub layer and on the ground are entirely declining, and significantly so. So this is just showing how the loss of the understory is translating into impacts to bird populations, for example. And on the next slide, this is studies from the Adirondacks area, and it shows that most of our forest birds are actually insectivores, and most of our forest insects specialize in particular plant species. So as the deer are impacting the plants in this way, we're seeing the x-axis in each of these graphs is showing an increasing deer population. So as the deer population increases, you can see tree diversity going down. As tree diversity goes down, you can see insect density goes down, and with insect density going down, the bird density goes down as well. So this is basically cascading through the ecosystem with this overabundant deer situation impacting a variety of other species throughout the forest, leading to an overall a depaupered ecosystem and an inability of these forests to support not just trees and wildflowers, but pretty much everything else that is depending on the forest ecosystem. The next slide is showing you that it's not limited to ecological effects either. We're seeing major impacts and concerns for public safety. There's over a million deer vehicle collisions per year in the United States, resulting in approximately 200 deaths per year on average. In New Jersey, there's been 13 deaths documented in the past 10 years from deer vehicle collisions, and in any given year, between 15 and 30,000 deer collisions in the state. State Farm Insurance estimates that this results in over $100 million per year in vehicle damage claims alone. And these are just the just for vehicle damage. It has nothing to do with pain and suffering, loss of life, medical bills, and so forth. And Clinton Township just made the news a week or two ago. There was an article identifying the top 20 towns in New Jersey that had the greatest number of deer vehicle collisions. And you were number 19 and the second highest in Hunterdon County.
I'm not surprised. I've had two in the last 13 years or so.
Yeah, and I, you know, depending on how hard you hit them and what your deductible is and whether you have collision insurance, you might not even be able to claim this. Like the three deer that I hit in Reddington were all below my deductible, and so there's many more vehicles that are being damaged than, and the likely average of vehicle damage alone for towns of this size in this part of the state is probably on the order of $1 million to $1.5 million per year that the public is paying in deer vehicle, just vehicle damage. Which is really just extraordinary. So there's major obvious concerns for public safety. And there's also concerns for public health. Everybody's aware at this point of Lyme disease, hopefully. And Hunterdon County has typically the top or the second highest number of Lyme disease incidences in New Jersey. And it's one of the hot spots in the eastern seaboard. And now, deer are not the main reservoir of Lyme disease where the ticks are getting it from. They usually get the disease itself from birds or rodents in the understory, but deer are the main hosts of the adult ticks, and they are the ones that are responsible for moving the ticks throughout the landscape. We've done some studies on tick and deer densities in our forests and have found a pretty close relationship between the densities of deer using a site and the abundance of ticks in those places. So there is a relationship that's important to understand as well. All right, so our study, the next page is probably impossible to read. The map there was always difficult to look at, even when it was in color. But we've been conducting this study. We have over 135 study sites now, primarily in central New Jersey, in the Raritan watershed, Piedmont part of the state. And we're trying to identify the effects of again, ticks, no, sorry, deer and invasive plants, but we also had to account for other factors. So we looked at three different forest types, forests on the mountains or rocky soils of this area, forests in the clay, the red shale soils that we have around, and forests along our floodplains of the major rivers in the area. And that's important to do because forests are different for all kinds of reasons, not just because of deer and invasive plants, and so we wanted to make sure that we accounted for natural variation in the forest as well. We did have a few sites that we selected in Clinton Township, but we didn't do a great deal of it. The two sites I think that we studied in Clinton were on Cushetunk Mountain Nature Preserve, which is actually one of the better quality forests in the area. Our data set at this point is enormous, and this is from last year, so our numbers are even higher than this at this point. We have over 50,000 trees that we've measured and identified, more than 500,000 seedlings, and an enormous amount of data on the herbaceous flora and the shrub and liana layer. And liana is just, in case you're not familiar with the term, just means woody vines. So things like grapevines and poison ivy, Virginia creeper, would count as lianas. And this part of the state is actually a great place to study forest ecology because we have the benefit of historical studies that were conducted by Rutgers researchers in the 1940s through the 1970s, which creates an incredible background data set for us to see how the forests have changed since the mid-20th century. And if you go back to that first slide that I... Oh, it's upside down. Sorry about that. That first slide that I showed, this time period is really before the deer explosion took place in New Jersey. So we can see what our forests looked like prior to this massive deer increase. It's also prior to the massive invasion of invasive plants, which took place primarily with suburban development, because these plants typically originate from our landscapes at home. And so I identified over 20 studies at this point that were conducted by different Rutgers researchers, and the beauty of it is that they all, for the most part, came from the same laboratory, so they used the same methods, and they went to different forests throughout this part of the state. And so by putting all that data together, we can see a pretty clear perspective on what the forests used to look like. And by going back to these places, or places that are similar to them, we can really see to the quantitative detail exactly how things have changed since that time period. So it's a priceless data set for perspective. And the next slide shows, I think, some of the more important results that we've found so far. And just for perspective, this is the one I'm looking at up here. Sorry to have my back to all of you. And this shows the left bar in each graph is the historical data from Rutgers. The second bar in each graph is the data from our data set. And the seedling numbers, even though there is a substantial decline compared to the historical data, this is not a significant decline. There's a lot of variation behind this average that you're seeing here. And we wouldn't expect a difference in seedling numbers anyway, because the seedlings are being replenished every year from seeds that are dropping from the trees above. The deer are typically eating these after the first year of growth. So the seeds will fall and start to grow in the spring. They would be measured in the forest, but it's the following winter when the deer start to resort to eating woody material in the forest that they would begin to mow down that seedling layer. So the place where we would expect to see the greatest change is in the sapling layer. These are trees that are over a foot tall, but less than an inch in diameter at 4 feet above the ground. So these are really the kind of trees that are going to be between 2 years old and approximately 10 to 15 years old, the ones that are the most accessible to deer in the landscape. And we do, in fact, see a dramatic decline that is significant in this case. And this is consistent across the board with any kind of forest that we looked at in any particular situation. We see a 90% decline in saplings in that layer of the forest. What I wasn't expecting to see was the next graph in the small tree category. These are trees that are an inch to 4 inches in diameter, which are typically way above the level that the deer can actually browse, because the canopies are far above what they can reach. And we're seeing a major 90% decline there as well. And what that means is that this impact that the deer are having in the forest has actually been going on for decades, because these trees are typically 15 years old or more. And so we're seeing now the legacy effects of deer in the forest preventing them from regenerating. And the scary thing is that if these trends continue, it isn't an exaggeration to say that we're going to see this moving into the larger tree category. As these larger trees die, whether it's from natural death, a lightning strike, a hurricane, or from some of these exotic pests and diseases that are being introduced, there's nothing in the understory there to replace them. And so we're going to actually begin to lose our forests in the next 50 to 100 years if these trends continue.
Are they eating them if they're up here and they can't reach them?
They're not. So what's happening typically in this category is these small trees are going to be growing up into this category.
Okay.
But there's nothing here to replace them.
I understand.
Right, so they're not getting replenished with these younger trees any longer. And so this is indicating that the impacts to forest understories have been going on probably for a minimum of 20 to 30 years to see this scale of effect. And that corresponds pretty closely with the numbers of deer that we see from the state statistics. So it's alarming to think about what this means for forest health in the future. And you can actually see this in some places, especially along highways, where you see increased disturbance to the canopies and trees blowing down because of the wind that you find along roadways. As the trees fall down and those gaps that are created, you don't see trees growing back up to replace them. You see a tangle of typically invasive vines and shrubs. And so we're going to end up with a landscape largely of wooded thickets rather than the forest that we have that we care about, if nothing is done about this problem.
In the interests of time, I think it's pretty well established that there are definitely some significant effects that the deer are having on the environment and people and safety. What kinds of solutions did you look at?
Okay, so I'll skip ahead. The next few slides are just about invasive plants and how they're replacing the deer in the understory. Further data documenting that it is, in fact, deer that's causing this as opposed to other potential factors that could be causing a decline in tree reproduction. If you skip to the first slide that says possible solutions for forest restoration, that's this one here that I'm looking at now.
Yep.
One simple strategy is installing enclosures, fencing off forests to protect them from deer. And I'll show you, if you go back to some of those slides, it works really well. You can go to Duke Farms and any number of places where enclosures have been set up for 10 to 20 years, and the forests return in their full glory. Regeneration kicks back in, and everything falls back into place. The problem with deer fencing is it's too expensive, and we can't fence off all the forests in the landscape. We wouldn't want to. It needs to be a minimum of 8 feet, typically. And so depending on what kind of fencing you use, what materials, on our campus we have 75 acres of forest, and it would cost us approximately $30,000 to $150,000 to fence it all off. And so that's not really realistic. And it's certainly not something that you could do at the township level. And so we need to think about other strategies.
I agree, yep.
So there's also a lot of work going on with tree planting. People are planting trees by the thousands in this part of the state. to try to put back what belongs there. And since we know exactly how many trees used to be present in the forest, we can quantify exactly what it would cost to replant the forest. That turns out to be even less economically feasible. It would cost to replant the same area of forest back to what they used to look like on our campus would cost $500,000, and that's without any kind of protections, and so the deer would just come and eat them all again.
And that's just for 176 acres.
That's just for 76 acres.
We have many more than that.
Right. So really the only feasible strategy to tackle deer at the level at which they're having an impact, which is the landscape level, or the regional level, really, is short of returning predators to the landscape, which is not going to be politically viable, is hunting. And there's different types of hunting systems that have been in place throughout different parts of the state, and so I broke it down on this slide into different general categories based on their effectiveness for environmental concerns, meeting environmental goals, as well as some of the general cost differences between them. Recreational hunting tends to be a low-cost option that you can implement on public preserves, for example, in the town, and many local preserves that the county owns and other systems do as well implement recreational hunting. The problem is that the goals of recreational hunters are not necessarily the same as goals for ecological management or for public safety concerns. Because the numbers are so high, a person that's going to be hunting to fill their freezer for a year with meat is not going to be able to do the work or is going to be interested in doing the work that it's going to take to actually drive the population down. And so we find that even though it's low cost or in some cases can actually generate revenue, depending on what kind of system you implement, it tends not to be very effective. Sharpshooters have also been implemented in places like Princeton, Bernard Township, and some local preserves like Duke Farms. That is really effective, works instantly, and these people are incredibly skilled at the work that they do, but it's also extremely expensive. It costs typically $200 to $300 per deer to have some of these professionals come in and tackle that problem. Another strategy that's been innovated by Duke Farms and Hopewell Valley Open Space and a number of other groups is working with what they call management hunters, or people that have ecological goals in mind and are willing to put in the time to drive the deer numbers down, and instead of taking one or two deer per year, taking 10 or 20 or 30 per year to bring the numbers down that are environmentally and socially sustainable. These can be really low cost and can be free if the hunters are willing to work for free, or in some cases they'll ask typically for reimbursements for the butchering that needs to be done to donate the meat to hunters helping the hungry, or for the feed that needs to be used to attract deer into the blinds that they're using. And the places that do this right have found that it's really effective, and I have some data in the next slide or two that can show you the results. There is also an interest in non-lethal methods using contraceptives of various kinds, and those studies have shown very little success that have been done, unfortunately. And they're also extremely expensive. So it takes between $4 to $1,000 per deer on average to inoculate them with a pharmaceutical. The major problems with doing it are that the deer need to be tagged individually, and so you have to keep track of which ones you're shooting. And on an annual or 2 to 3 year basis, typically you have to re-implement the chemicals, the contraceptives to keep them from reproducing. So the prospect of identifying all the deer and relocating them and then injecting them with the contraceptives in an open environment like this is really problematic. It works really well in parks and preserves where the deer are enclosed because you can keep track of who's who, but in the open environment that's not the case. And there are some new pharmaceuticals that are being experimented with that the data is still not in yet as far as how effective they are, but the ones that are on the market appear not to be effective as a solution, unfortunately. So if you look at the different hunting strategies on this slide now, we collected data in places where these different hunting programs are being implemented, and you can see the results of exclosures compared to sharpshooters, plus management hunting, sharpshooters, and recreational hunting, and then other examples. And you can see that there's a range of effectiveness. But all these different programs, whether they're sharpshooting or management hunting, can show substantial results in improving forest conditions in the understory. And this is, again, just looking at that sapling layer of trees that's the most vulnerable to deer. If you have either no hunting at all or recreational hunting only, you tend to see no benefits whatsoever for forest regeneration because they're just not bringing the numbers down to the levels that the forests need for that to happen. You also see in the next slide a translation of public safety benefits almost instantly. So Princeton, for example, and Berners Township, when they implemented the hunting programs in the early 2000s with sharpshooters, they dropped the deer population down by 60%. And they saw in that same year a 60% decrease in deer vehicle collisions. Bernard Township, Bernards gave up on the sharpshooting because they found it to be too expensive to sustain over time. So they have moved to the management hunters, working with small groups of skilled hunters to get the job done. And this is just from this past year. It was I heard that they were able to find similar successful reduction in their deer vehicle collisions, in this case, over 80%.
And just to return briefly to the previous slide, so roughly equivalent you found recreational hunting to be with no hunting?
Yes. And this is just in terms of how it affects the saplings and the understory. So there might be other benefits.
Yeah.
In terms of if you're concerned about deer problems in general, some hunting is better than no hunting because your numbers will be drawn down, and that's less likelihood of vehicle collisions and everything else. But if you really want to see results for forests and other ecosystems and everything else that we're concerned about, it doesn't seem to be very effective.
So what's the population of people participating in the management hunting?
It depends on the size of the preserves. This is typically being done with either individual parks and preserves or preserve systems. So at Duke Farms, for example, they started with kind of an open invitation for hunters to join them, and I think they started with about 40 hunters, if I remember right, and they've gotten it down over time to about 10 or 12 that they use on their, it's a 2,000 to 3,000 acre property. Hopewell Township Open Space, Friends of Hopewell Valley Open Space, I think is their official name, they use a similar number, I think it's 10 to 20 hunters, if I remember correctly, on their piecemeal properties throughout Hopewell Township.
So it's not a scarce resource?
Hunters?
Hunters.
Hunters are not scarce. There are many people that are interested in finding better access.
I'm sorry, the management. The recreational hunters, there's a lot of them, but
right.
You say they go out, they get one, maybe they get two, they're done. The management hunting, I assume, would be 10, 12, maybe more. Those people.
Those are a much more scarce resource, and there's a lot of work being done right now to locate hunters that have that interest in working in that regard. And also in training people to do it, because it does take a certain level of skill if people are not hunting properly. And I've heard this from the hunters. I'm not a hunter myself. But it's pretty the deer are not stupid and can be scared off of the properties pretty easily. Or they can change their behavior and they resort to nocturnal feeding behaviors where it's illegal to hunt at night. So if you don't hunt carefully, you can actually cause the deer to leave the property during the day, come back and feed from your bait stations at night, making them much more difficult to hunt.
Is there a special licensure for management hunting?
No, you can hunt with the existing state regulations. Even in the most strict circumstances, I believe up to 30 to 38 deer per year in a given hunting season. And in the more liberal areas, like this part of the state where it's a less restrictive hunting season, you can take many more than that. We worked with just two hunters on our campus. This was the first year that we implemented a hunting program on our 240-acre property. We had two hunters coming in just on weekends. And just using bow hunting, they were able to drop our deer population from 200 per square mile down to 100 per square mile in just one season. And we had no problems. People didn't know they were there. They were very discreet, and they were incredibly effective. So, but they're a rare breed. So there is a great need for these people, but they are out there, and there are local people that are able to do this. If you're going to implement a hunting program, since recreational hunting is probably not going to get the job done if you want to benefit the environment, there are some things that you can implement in a hunting program that I've listed here, and this is not a complete list. But having the proper incentives of various kinds, having hunters report how many deer are being taken as a minimum from the properties that they're working on, so you can begin to get some data on how many deer you're removing from the population each year. Creating incentives of various kinds, subsidizing hunters, again, to reduce the butchering fees if they're going to be donating the meat, for example. These are just different things that fall into place that other preserve systems and hunting programs have used in the interest of management hunting. Changing the focus from buck hunting and trophy hunting to hunting does is one of the primary things people need to be focused on, because it's the does that are responsible for the deer population increasing. A single doe can produce, on average, it used to be they would have just one fawn per year. On average now, it's two or more in a given year. And some does are actually producing three in a year because there's so much more food in the landscape for them. So focusing on the drawing the doe population down is actually the primary goal for management hunting. And whatever rules get put in place for your hunting program, of course, monitoring and enforcement of those rules is important to make sure that the incentives that you're implementing actually work. Hunters Helping the Hungry is a great program. If you're going to be taking, you know, more than one or two deer a year, most hunters don't know what to do with that. And this is an excellent program that's been going on for over 20 years now that has produced an enormous amount of food to help people hungry. It's illegal to sell deer meat in New Jersey, but you can donate it. And so this goes to food shelters throughout the state. And unfortunately, the state doesn't subsidize the program itself, so it does cost money to butcher the deer. Depending on the size of the deer, it's $10 to $30 per deer, and so it's a marginal cost that can be covered by the town or potentially other sources if that's something you're interested in doing to help incentivize this hunting. And then lastly, from my perspective as a scientist, it's important to have evidence and data behind decision-making and management of any kind. And so having data on what the deer population is to begin with, and then collecting data continually to see if your hunting program is actually working to the degree that you want it to is an important aspect to make sure that the policies are effective and that we're being accountable to the public that we're serving. And so we've been assisting local towns and parks with this. The past 2 years have done some surveys in Raritan Township. We surveyed the whole town this past year. They just implemented a hunting program on their open space properties, and we were able to demonstrate for them that they were effectively reducing their population on those properties by an average of 15%, and the properties that they hadn't hunted instead increased on average 26%. So that was pretty good data for them to show them that what they were doing was actually working. It wasn't necessarily bringing the deer population down very quickly when you've got 81 per square mile in the town as a whole. You know, a 15% decline is not going to be ecologically sustainable for probably the next 10 or 20 years, but it is a positive trend at least. So they had some indication that the program was working, and they could find ways to fine-tune it to improve it. We also installed some forest monitoring plots for them so they could see how their forest compared with others throughout the state, and they could go back to these places in 5 or 10 years and see if the forests are responding to those programs as well. So these are simple strategies that you could implement as well. If you're interested, asking the police department to keep track of deer vehicle collisions as another indicator of how your program is translating into public safety benefits is another simple solution that can provide you with meaningful information. And the state deer biologists at the DEP have been working with communities throughout the state, but especially in this part of the state where it's such a problem. And they've got a lot of expertise and resources that they could provide you with.
In your Raritan study, was there any data collected in regards to deer versus auto, deer versus pedestrian, bicycle, et cetera?
They collected that separately, and I don't know what the results are for this particular year. This was the first year that the program was implemented, so I can't tell you that, unfortunately. We did the same thing on our campus, so this was how we were able to demonstrate that the campus policy was working. We've worked with Flat Rock Nature Preserve in Englewood, with Watchung, Borough. A lot of towns are interested in this with good reason. So that's just an example of what's possible.
I would just, we're coming up close to half hour, so let me just make a couple of remarks. My former life, I managed a large site, you know, in Hunterdon over at the Merck Place, about 1,000 acres. And there was a hunting program over there that, again, was invisible. Two clubs took approximately 60 or 70 deer out per year. And before that, I was a relatively long-term trustee at NorWestCAP, which is the Master Food Bank. It's a social services construct for the northwestern five counties. And protein in a food bank is rare. Got a lot of starches and whatnot, but not much protein. So the idea was first, really, keep the poachers out. We had a real issue, and that was a safety issue to our neighbors with uncontrolled hunting on the property. And once the clubs took over, they posted it, and the poachers went away. They were insured. They had informal goals in terms of the number of deer to be harvested. I think our forests were in good shape. The company donated money to Hunters Helping the Hungry every year to butcher the deer, and they ended up at NorWestCAP in the food bank. So it seemed to be a pretty nice cycle. Our forests certainly looked very healthy compared to what I saw when I wandered off, you know, with my chainsaw on that, you know, kind of cold day in the early spring. So I wonder if this would make sense to council. If we formed a group to study this in depth, a couple of members from council, I'd be pleased to be on it, somebody from Open Space, somebody from EC, and I know I'm leaving somebody out, but and of course, Jesse, our administrator. And Tom, you want to? Okay. Yeah, why don't we get a group, that group together? We've got more detailed information from the professor and also from Rich, and you know, put our heads together as a sort of a community, and make recommendations to council in terms of how we might proceed, or who knows, we might decide not to proceed. But you know, really take it under advisement. Can't do that in a half hour.
Sure.
And see if we can't take a position, and if we decide we're going to proceed, come up with, I don't know, maybe a trial program, pick a couple of locations that are, we know have poachers, one, two, are relatively insulated from neighbors, pretty far away from residences, you know, that kind of thing, and see if it makes sense to start, again, if we're going to proceed, baby steps for the first year, and then see where we go.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. I think it's definitely an issue that we've recognized for a while, but we haven't had a good agreed-upon solution, and I think that you really need the input from the Environmental and Open Space Commissions in order to make that something that will work in the long term and be productive. And I know some folks get skittish about hunting, but yeah. I think it'll be a positive thing if we come up with a really good deer management plan. And I'd be curious to know if the open space and environmental folks have a sense of which parcels are most affected by deer, or if they're all similarly so. Either of you.
Thank you, Doug. Brian, let me just make a couple comments on that. One is that Professor Kelly was saying, you know, having an evidence base and having an actual monitoring plan would show you where you have deer populations and then how that changes over time. It's also true that we have statistics which are perhaps a surrogate for where some of the key areas would be, which is the accident deer car collisions. And we have reports, and yes, I got some great information from the police department. Thank you.
That's fantastic.
And I put it together, but it's manual to do. But you can really start to see some concentrations, and I have to get more data, and I'll put that together. And the thing is, as you would expect, the areas where we're having a lot of the deer collisions are areas that have more population. Mm-hmm. So the tendency of, say, going to, you know, Windy Acres or something, there's much less in the way of collisions there, but it's an easy place to implement management hunting.
Right.
So that's a trade-off that we have to look at.
It might be because there's less cars around there.
That's true, but there are some places with few cars that have a lot of accidents
right.
still.
Okay.
Grey Rock Road is just crazy, in fact. I do also want to just say one other point. Cindy Kunstner from the DEP came here, and we've had full cooperation and support. They reached out and contacted us, and I very much appreciate that.
Professor Kelly, I have a question. I recall you saying that you can't sell deer meat in New Jersey.
Yeah, well, there are some exemptions. I believe if people have farms with deer populations on them that are captive deer that are documented and raised specifically for that purpose, then they can sell the venison, but you can't sell the...
Can you sell it in Pennsylvania and New York?
I believe it's federal regulation that prevents it.
Yeah, so the farm thing is what I was thinking about. We talked about a fence to keep the deer out. We'll take this offline, but another idea might be to relocate the deer and turn it into a farm. I don't know how much it costs to capture the deer.
It's really expensive.
But I mean, so I'm the one who always thinks out of the box. And it sounds like a good business if you could sell it.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, if it's $30 to butcher it and you can sell it for more than $30.
I don't know that you'd be allowed to trap and keep wild deer under those same federal rules yourself.
It's something to look into.
But the cost of trapping them is extraordinary, and Duke Farms actually did that at first because Doris Duke was an animal rights lover,
right.
or animal lover, an animal rights activist. And so when they first tried to manage the population, they started by trapping and relocating them, and they immediately found that it was ineffective and extraordinarily expensive, and so they abandoned that. So they can give you numbers and could probably give you some perspective on the options there. And just to give you a sense of the scale of it, our surveys in Raritan Township, we covered, it's a 36-square-mile town, if I remember correctly. Our surveys covered about 30% of that area with what we were sampling the deer population, and we counted over 1,100 deer. So they probably have 3,000 to 5,000 deer, and the prospects of relocating 80 to 90% of that, I don't know how that would be even possible.
And at the rate that
possible.
They grow, you'll just have them back again.
And then,
well, as it happens, the rate that they grow moves to the farm.
Yeah.
At what point do they stop populating that square mile? Like, you know, you said you had 300. At what point does it no longer sustain them? Is it 500, 600?
It's a good question. I don't know that anybody has come to a clear answer. It depends on a lot of the details, like what's available locally to support them
right.
and so forth.
Okay. I don't want to take up any more time with Mike.
I'm happy to talk to you later if you have other comments or questions.
How do we get in touch with you?
I always forget my cards, but Rich Shaw has
Rich.
My email,
okay.
and I'm on the school's website. You know,
okay.
It's just jkelly@raritanval.edu.
Great. Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
It's a good presentation. Thank you very much.
Sorry it took so long speaking through it.
Sorry we didn't have a projector.
All the factors, I understand.
Yes. So we have experimental evidence showing that from these large-scale exclosures, when you exclude deer but nothing else changes, like people are still in there at Duke Farms, people are driving around, there's still acid rain, anything else that could be drawing down the tree numbers besides deer are still happening in those exclosures. And if you look at the results from those places, the forest restores itself within a 5 to 10 year period.
Kind of like deductive reasoning.
Nothing else is different except the deer are removed. And so if you see the forest responding as a result, you can identify deer as the cause.
Right. I forget statistics, but that's some type of variable there. The deer, you remove the deer and nothing else, but whatever.
Right. It's, I guess, a control. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
anything else? Right. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And fortuitously, probably, we're up to the public comment period, so if any members of the public have any comments about this or any other topic, you're welcome to come up. Please.
I'm Cindy Kinsner, New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. I'm a senior wildlife biologist, and although I'm not going to take your time to discuss what I was going to, Dr. Kelly did a fabulous job. You know the background. You know what your needs are. You already have identified the problem and potential solutions. I just want to offer our agency's support. We can meet with you, meet with your committee if you form a deer management advisory committee or task force, whatever your township chooses to call it. So, again, I don't want to take too much time, but we do work with municipalities all through the state. Most recently, we're working with Plainsboro Township. They had, you probably wouldn't have this need, but they changed, they had ordinance changes and resolution, and we're developing a program for them. While it might not be ideal because it is regulated hunting, not the goal is a management hunt, it is not the goal as a recreational hunt, just as Dr. Kelly said. You have to start somewhere, and if you can't isolate those or identify or secure individual skilled hunters, you can have a controlled, regulated hunt where the goal is management, not recreation. So if there's any way our agency can support you, provide information, answer questions, we'd be happy to perform that service. And if you had other questions, I'm just respecting your time and not going through what I had prepared, so I'll be happy to address any questions.
If you have something prepared that's written, feel free to
Only for myself. I mean, this is my notes to present to you.
Okay. I do. Yeah, leave us some contact information and we'll certainly reach out.
Good question?
No, business card.
Oh, yes, sure.
Anyone else from the public? Please.
Hi, my name is Joe Schultz. I live in Clinton Township on Old Mountain Road. I work in Clinton Township. I work for Viking Pest Control. But I've been a hunter my whole life. I'm also one of the founders, as well as Les and Mike, that started Hunter's Help and Hungry. It does cost us about $75 to process a deer. The hunter is paying approximately $20 per deer that they harvest, and we cover the rest of the expenses. It is total donations that we work off of. We're not government funded or county or town sponsored. Some of the towns we do accept deer from, they are paying for the processing. They're having the sharpshooters come in, dropping it off at a certified butcher, that the meat is inspected so that it can be donated to food banks throughout New Jersey. The program started here in Hunterdon because we have the largest deer population here, but we've expanded statewide. But again, most of your deer are in the northern counties here. So last year we processed over 800 deer, and we're approaching 2 million meals that we've donated so far, all by donations from hunters. So that's my take on it. We'd be more than happy to work with the town, and you know, if the hunters were supported to pay for the butchering, that helps the incentive for the hunter to harvest the deer. If he's going to keep paying to bait the deer, spend his time, shoot the deer, gut the deer, take it to a check station, take it to the butcher, and all of that, it's time and effort and money. You're only going to do that so much. But if you need a control, help the hunter absorb some of those costs, and hopefully it would be very effective. So, thank you.
All right, thank you. Anyone else? It's going, gone. So thank you all very much, and we'll get that committee together, and we'll figure out how we want to proceed and what the program looks like. As it happens, our municipal attorney is the municipal attorney for Princeton, and she has lots of experience in related ordinance work. So we're lucky to have also good in-house counsel with lots of appropriate experience. All right, we're up to reports. Mr. Kochanowski.
I have nothing to report. Summer rec is over. We're going to pay the kids today.
I hope so.
I felt so old reading that list. It used to be I knew every single kid's name on that list. Now I know three.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess that means I'm up. And we had a finance committee meeting this morning to do a half-year budget check-in just to see where we were with actuals versus our budget as far as revenue and expenditure, and I think things are shaping up pretty good more than halfway through the year, so we'll Jess and Len are keeping a good eye on things, and I think we're heading in the right direction and should continue to grow our surplus, fingers crossed, but I think that's going in the right direction, so we're very pleased to see that. And CTSA met, the sewer authority did, on the 26th. There was a request on Hamden Road to tie in. There are some technical issues that they'll have to try to overcome and evaluate, but short and long of it is a failing septic, and potentially they have the ability to tie into an existing main. There were some other conversations with regard to litigation that I'll skip. They're still working on mediation with the town of Clinton. Hopefully that can get wrapped up soon, and they've been working on some pump station upgrades.
Yeah.
And then they reviewed their audit, and their audit had the revenue was higher. They had a nice receipt from the hotel over on Route 31.
Oh, that's right, the payback.
That's going up, yeah. And, yeah, they're doing pretty well, and they haven't had to bond for any of their capital work. I know they've had a rate increase, but they've managed to not have to bond and take on any debt to finance all the capital improvements that they've been doing, the pump station upgrades and all that fun stuff. So,
county's been there for a while, and that's one of our goals.
That is something I really am hoping, and I think with Jess and Len and Tom, we're headed in that direction. In a few years, we'll be able to dial back what we've had to do to bond in order to do
cash,
roads.
Pay as you go.
Pay as you go. That's what we want.
Getting there.
I'm done.
Historic met August 1st. They are purchasing the Hamden Historic sign, just for the PO or to Jesse. They're very interested in the ordinance of the abandoned homes. Mm-hmm. They want the cost house addressed.
Which one is that?
That's on the corner of Gray Rock and Center Street
by
Doctor's Inn.
Yeah.
So as far as the wish list goes, that was the top.
Yeah. Right next to the old Caldwell.
Yep. And what do they want to do with it?
What was that?
I didn't hear you. What are they, what was their concern?
The cost house.
But what do they want to do with it? They wanted it addressed.
They want it addressed to whoever.
Okay, well, we were out there today. Tom,
oh, you were?
We were.
Great, I'll email that.
They're going to get, fix it up, you know, stabilize it, make it safe. That letter will go out this week.
Excellent.
That one and the old Caldwell back there next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Runkle House.
Good.
Okay. All three of them.
Good.
We got a 10 today.
And the Beaverbrook, I guess it was moved to September when they're going to break ground over there?
September was what I...
August and September.
August.
I thought September, October, I thought it was. I thought it was September for the footings.
I thought it was August, late August for clearing.
Well, they were wondering why it wasn't happening now. So they were a little behind on salvaging some of the items.
Oh, okay.
A lot of things are really deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, maybe taking one small building and trying to take it piece by piece and putting that together again is off the table.
Like mementos.
Right, so they're going to try to get on that right away. Obviously, there's...
Yeah, Ingerman has no issue with that.
Right.
If you need me to call Jeff Long or somebody.
No, I think they got it all.
Okay.
Yeah, they're ready to go. I had asked if we could do the JCP&L thing September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Just basically a presentation about maintenance as we go into the winter months. I just want everybody to be on the same page, residents, us, them.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, definitely. Because we just had enough... What?
They've started.
Oh, I know. They do it, but it would be nice if we heard it, they presented it, and
the
residents heard it.
And we could provide some feedback on what went wrong last
time. What went wrong, yes. Politely, of course. The dog park, Jesse's been updating me on that. They have the water lines in, and he sent me some pictures of the water. It's flowing for the garden and the dog park, so really exciting. The book exchange box, I sent you guys some pictures of the Girl Scouts doing that. Really cute. They're doing, it was for, you know, adults, and they decided to do a child's one. So they're going to exchange child's books in the other
very
one.
Very cool.
So, and that was their idea. So cute. And just August, they're going to be done, and then DPW is just going to help us install them next to the dog park. I was talking to Eric in regards to Running of the Lions. That's October 21st. I just wanted to remind everybody to run
or walk.
to register or walk. I know
I
saw in a report that the driveway might be going in mid-October, so I wanted to touch base with him. October 21st, will it be all cleaned up?
We'll try and get it before that.
Before, it's like a couple weeks.
So we'll have parking there, it'll be easier to get across the street.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch base with him. I didn't know what he needed and exactly what route they're taking, but I just told him we would either do it way before, clean it up, or after. So before.
We should probably get it done.
Yeah. Okay. That's it.
We have a correction. Okay. Brian's got a better memory.
September 1st for the footings and November-ish for foundation at Beaver Ave on the
I wonder if that'll change.
It's construction. Things always change in construction.
Yeah.
I can speak from experience.
But I got to think they're going to be clear.
There's some motivation there, too.
I got to think they'll be cleaning up and clearing out, you know, sometime in August, hopefully. Anyway, my only report really is the planning board. We had a capital review for a new, basically a two-car garage-type full building to go in on Bunn Park to store recreational equipment. So that's by the planning board, and I think Jess will probably talk about, you know, when it's going to go in. And the planning board accorded, I had a recuse on this, so I listened from the judges' chambers back there. The planning board provided preliminary approval to the old municipal building project in Annandale Village. And they'll be back for final once there's a, you know, the prints are updated and a lot of the fine points are taken care of. I'm thinking I could hope to see something happen before the winter sets in, but more likely early spring next year.
And make sure we update some of the neighbors.
Yeah. Well, they were there.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the neighbors asked for a timetable and got that kind of a timetable. Maybe demolition, something like that could happen sooner.
The sooner the better.
Amen to that. It's been It's been 3 years, you know, but it's going to happen.
It'll be worth it.
Oh, my God, yeah. That's it for me.
I think I mentioned at the last meeting the school board had the K through 8 school board had an opening due to a resignation of one of their members. They had five people actually come to the meeting on July 31st and put in for that position, which runs between now and the end of the year. They did select one of those individuals. What I always find fascinating is that when you have an issue like that, an issue being that much discussion taking place in social media, everybody's concerned about that, and then you turn around and you look in the auditorium at the, and you see there's five people in there. I'm one of the five. And three of the people that are supporting one of the candidates and one of the other people that's there as a child watching it. And I mention that because we really don't have a good way of getting information out to the public that everybody sees, hears, and understands. So it's kind of interesting to see not a lot of interest from the public on what the selection was. A number of these people that weren't selected will be running in the November election for the school board. So it's liable to be a pretty good showing, or at least a good slate of candidates that's there. The individual that was selected for the position seemed like a very competent person. And that goes by Robert or Bob Holliday. Very big guy, a lot of experience, been doing a lot of things in the township. So it, I think, will be a good addition to the Board of Education. Jesse and I also met with Comcast this week. I'll let him do a lot of the updates on that. But Rob Chilton, who is the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs, did come back and give us a recommendation for franchise renewal with a couple of different options that we can look at and present to council. We'll be giving to council in the next week or so is a full report on the franchise agreement and what the committee came up with, what our recommendations are. That's going to be split out because we came out with two things. One was the franchise renewal, and also there was a recommendation that we thought was something we should look at, which we did, and that is to look at the possibility of a municipal internet, and that is Clinton Township setting up an internet on our own to provide services to the community and others partnering with other communities. And we've got our results on that. It's not something that we're going to be recommending.
I'm shocked.
You are?
Good call, good call.
It could have something to do with your wallet. But we did want to look at that and make sure we explored it and didn't just poo-paw it based on a rumor. We looked at it very thoroughly, did a comparison with another community that's getting a lot of publicity. I don't understand why they're getting that publicity because they really don't have much of a success. But it is some good data, and it did provide us with the opportunity to have a comparator to look at what we're doing rather than just look at data and put that together with suppositions. We have to have some solid data to look at. So, Jess, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, we've got our Class 3 police officers are well on the way to being sworn in and uniformed and trained. I think Ryan can give you some more detail on that, but that's in the works for probably starting in September. We'll get them in here, get them sworn in the next few weeks once they get to that point. We are also swearing in our newest police officer, Officer Ramos, Monday, pending final checks. I mean, I think he's all done with all his backgrounds and all that stuff, but he's ready to go, so that's a good thing. Replace one of the officers that we hired earlier this year that left, mm-hmm. So that's good. We are good at the park, with the dog park and the garden. They're ready to go. I put my report, they'll be ready this week. They're done, so the water's flowing, and we'll get in there, clean it up, put some grass seed down. And Amy and I are talking about next year improvements to the park, and I'm looking for some donations for that. So that's all good. Dan and I did meet with Mr. Clifton from Comcast, and we'll give you the full recommendation, but I think, you know, we'll go with one of the longer-term options that he recommended for the financial incentive. And again, we'll have that in the next meeting or two. We'll be able to talk about that. Recreation summer camp is over. And again, our crew did a good job. Barbara and Tom, you know, really have a good program. If you've never been out to see it, the kids are all moving and doing things, and they're all busy and happy. You know, it was a good experience for all of them. I'd like to just thank those two, you know, publicly for, you know, it's a lot to put into it, and it was well done again. Next up, we have the Haunted Halloween with costume competition and a costume and parent dog competition for costumes. We're going to have a doggy parade with the parents and the dogs or families. We're looking for themes here to come out, and you're going to be judged with Jamie, you and I'll judge. And I think it's very popular where they do it. And so we'll get that advertised and get that going. It's a good thing for the community.
I'm all over
our road preparations are moving along. We're almost done milling. So if anybody asks, their milling is not quite your neighborhood.
They're in it now.
They're in it now, but they're not there done yet. The paving will start next week. The goal to be done paving at the end of next week.
If one of the things on that that's surprised me, yesterday I stopped at a sewer. And, of course, there was a guy down in the bottom of the sewer doing some work in there. And when I drive around the township and I see all the sewers and I see these little cones that are there, I go, oh, yeah, look at that. They've got to do some paving around that. That's not what they got to do. They've got to get into that sewer. They've got to take out portions of that, put in more block and more mortar and that. There's a lot more work to that than I think people recognize. It looks like, what's it take them, 6 to 8 hours to do the ends? Forget the milling around it.
Yes.
6 to 8 hours to do each rebuild?
That's done by hand.
Wow.
When's our next newsletter come up? Because maybe a little DPW, what's going on, what we've done, and how things work, and when you see stuff like that, why you...
Yeah, what are they doing?
Why does it take so long? What are we working on?
Some of the new equipment?
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure. So that is happening. We will be doing the parking for the fitness trail, Amy. Hopefully that'll be done. I've got the plans done. So that's a matter of just Jay's got to get
it. Like a huge
no, he's got to get in there and do it. But it'll be done right. We'll have signage and all that stuff. So that'll be good. And then parking for Prostack property. You know, there's an access. People have to walk through or drive through the farmyard there. So we've got property across the street. Jay can put in a little gravel lot and a kiosk on that side. So that solves that problem. And, again, that's a small job for the fall in between the bigger jobs that we're working on. Board of Health Ordinance, we have that on for introduction, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Amendment?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Police promotion eligibility, we talked about that. That will get us set up to speed things up in the future. I mean, we'll have our list of candidates, and if they're still available and eligible, no problems. When we do have a spot, we can move a lot faster than this last round, which is good for everybody. And we did meet with the Finance Subcommittee, and we're looking good. That's all I got.
You left one item out.
What?
Just snuck in a new flagpole. So our
it really
looks like one now.
Yeah. But we do have a new flagpole with a light, as we're supposed to have at the municipal building.
You said lit.
Yep.
Perfect.
Of course.
So.
Yes, sir. I really don't have anything to report. Several of the officers had forwarded a list in reference to the Comcast issue of trees on wires and some pretty substantial problems with that. Because they're out there all the time. They're traveling down the road. So we could put an email out just saying, hey, now's the time to speak about it. That was forwarded to Jess.
Oh, thank you for doing that.
You have my statistics, and I really don't have anything to report. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
But they're busy.
Yeah, so. Certainly seems so.
Yeah, absolutely.
By the way.
Well, you are busy. You got to tell people.
Just a question. At the planning board on Monday night, the lights went out.
Yeah.
No problem.
And then, of course, I left my glasses up here and car keys and the push buttons to let us back in don't work, so I had to get a ride home. You know what?
For the side trip to McDonald's.
There's a problem with the backup generator?
It didn't start.
Yeah.
Right.
But do you know what the cause was? I saw equipment going south on Route 31.
I do not.
Okay.
I just know the next morning I came in, I know Jay was out looking at the backup generator.
Yeah, so Mike was here too. But things were working.
I'll find out.
Is that what it was? Yeah. That's what it felt like.
No, it was a pole
was out of time.
Okay. When we saw the engines going down the highway, that's where they were.
Okay.
Thank you for that. I should be telling you that. A lady
is the report.
Coming to say her daughter has driven over the live wires to the pull down.
Absolutely. That was why it was an allergy.
That's scary. Okay. Well, thank you.
Hopefully you become less busy as we get rid of you.
Yeah. Oh, everything was still here. I just, just got the push buttons worked the next day.
Teach you not to forget.
Yeah. Well, it was dark. Okay.
That hallway was pitch black.
Yeah. All right. We're up to resolutions. And the first one is a resolution approving an eligibility list for the Clinton Township Police Department. And these are folks that are now eligible to be promoted to sergeant.
Yes, sir. And they've been vetted. They've been interviewed. Mm-hmm. They've gone through the entire process. I mentioned this a few meetings ago. But what that ordinance does is it keeps the list open and the rank in which they finish for 2 years. And obviously, if there's nothing to preclude them during those 2 years and say, I retire, someone else retires, and there's movement, that saves time and money where you can simply select the next eligible person on the list. It makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Me too. Does it make enough sense?
I'll make a motion to approve the resolution.
I'll second. Adopted. Yeah.
Councilwoman
Swift.
Yes.
Councilwoman Yes.
Councilwoman
Yes.
Council President
Yes. And the second resolution is a resolution authorizing a stipend to be paid to counselors and coordinators for the summer rec program. Pardon me, this is a $100 stipend for those folks who missed no days of work.
I'll make a motion.
Second.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. The next one is authorizing the hiring of Christopher Ramos as a police officer. And this, gosh, this is the third one, regular police officer that we've hired in maybe, what, 3 months?
Yes, 3 months.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you're working the new ones too hard.
We had a lot of retirements. We had one transfer. Somerset County Prosecutor's Office, and we're down. In 2012 and 2013, we had 28 officers, and we're down to 22. Mm. We had 22 police officers in 1990 with special officers, and I've seen the township grow exponentially since then.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a complaint, it's just really a fact. We need them.
Okay, I'll move adoption of the resolution.
I'll second.
Yes.
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 Yes. The next and last item is a resolution for the renewal of township liquor license for the 2018 and 19 license term. This is a license, if I recall correctly, held by basically the bank, and they got around to renewing it. So that's a little cash in hand, so that's a good thing. I'll make the motion.
Second.
Councilwoman Swetler?
Yes.
Councilman Kaczmanowski?
Yes.
Councilman Millay?
Yes.
Council President McTiernan?
Yes.
Mayor Hagan?
Yes. All right. We're now up to actions. The first one is an adoption of an ordinance. It's ordinance number 1117-18, an ordinance of the Township of Clinton, amending and supplementing Section 4-52E of the Code of the Township of Clinton to create the category of Class 3 special officers pursuant to NJSA 40A-14-146.9, etc. Basically, this describes third-class officers that would be hired to provide school safety. It's a relatively new statute passed by New Jersey, and our local high school, North Hunterdon, is taking advantage of it.
And Trishka, just to clarify, if I remember correctly, we don't necessarily need the ordinance because it's provided for by state statute, but this is just so that we have something that outlines it.
Correct.
With some specificity for us.
Yeah, what you currently have on the books is, you know, it's generic that you can have special officers, and, you know, it mainly references the statute. This ordinance would track the statute a little more closely, identify the three different classes of special officers, what their duties are, and then especially with respect to the Class 3, it really lays out what they can and can't do, right, which, you know, among other things, we hope will be helpful to parents who may be curious about what these officers are doing in their kids' schools. Yeah.
More discussion?
No.
All right, I'll open the public hearing. Are there any members of the public that have any comments, concerns, or questions about this ordinance? Okay, hearing and seeing no hands or motion, could I have a vote?
Motion.
Second.
Oh, I thought it. Now, the last meeting, I got hollered at for not having a vote to close the public hearing.
I'm sorry.
I'll move to
you
close.
Just can't win.
I'll move to close the public hearing.
Just change the rules.
Okay. Brian?
I'll second it.
He already did. And I seconded it.
I'm sorry.
So then we've got
a motion to approve
and
it.
And then I second it.
Yeah. Just we'll go back into the right order.
Yes.
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 Yes. Okay, thank you. The next item is also an ordinance adoption. It's ordinance number 1118-18. An ordinance of the Township of Clinton repealing and replacing in its entirety Chapter 151 of the Code of the Township of Clinton regarding affordable housing to address the requirements of the Fair Housing Act and the Uniform Housing Affordability Controls, UHAC, and to comply with the Township's third-round affordable housing obligations. This is a soup-to-nuts update of our affordable housing regulations to reflect changes in the laws and the procedures and our agreements over the years. And, you know, it's very comprehensive. So any questions or concerns on the part of council?
No, pretty straightforward.
Okay. I'll open the public hearing again, or a public hearing again. Any concerns, comments, or questions from the public? Everybody's quiet back there once again, so could I...
Motion to close the public hearing?
There you go.
Motion to approve?
Second.
Councilwoman Switwick?
Yes.
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 Yes. The next one, now we're into introduction of ordinances. This is Ordinance 1119-18, an ordinance amending Article 2 and Chapter 220 of the Code of the Township of Clinton regarding individual subsurface sewage disposal systems, a.k.a. septic systems. And the council adopted the role, the function of
Board of Health.
Board of Health, thank you. A couple of years ago, and we had three instances where township regulations were significantly more stringent than state regulations. We corrected one, and these two we wanted a little bit more experience with before we changed certain limits from ours, which are twice as stringent as the state, back to the state limits. And we've had numerous requests to repair septic systems that came to the council. They always bumped up against our regs being too stringent. They found they were able to fit the repaired septic systems to conform to state regs, but not ours. And we uniformly said yes to it. So this is a simple change in terms of language. We just, Trishka just took a paragraph out of the current regs, and now the state regulations prevail. So any discussion or concerns?
No, it's a good thing.
Yeah, we'll save our taxpayers some money.
Exactly.
And time.
The public hearing's next month?
Correct.
September.
Yeah. So, could I have a motion?
To introduce.
Thank you.
Second.
Councilwoman Switwick.
Yes.
Councilwoman
Kaczynowski. Yes.
Yes.
Councilman
Malloy.
Yes.
Council President McCarron.
Yes.
Mayor
Higgins. Yes, thank you. The next three introductions all relate to the new affordable housing plan, and these are basically zoning regulations. The affordable housing developments in our township, and I guess most townships, are accorded separate and distinct zoning regulations, setbacks and everything, and height, and you know all the various parameters that go into putting a building on a piece of land, because they're typically more densely constructed than the average development in our township, and that's simply a case of economics. So the first one of these is Ordinance 1120-18. It's an ordinance of the Township of Clinton amending Chapter 165 of the Code of the Township of Clinton by creating the AH6 and AH7 affordable housing zoning districts to facilitate affordable housing developments on the 108 Alton Place lot, block 79.07, lot 1, and a 9-acre plus or minus portion of the LeCompte property, which is block 29, lot 4, amending the Clinton Township zoning map and schedule of zoning requirements accordingly, and correcting the section numbers in Article 22B, AH5, Affordable Housing District. So these are two of the projects that are in our current plan, and again, it's these are very specific zoning regulations, as they say, setbacks, height limits, and that sort of thing. There were a couple of very small changes in these. Gosh, just over the last day or so, we had a mediation session with the court's special master and the developer, the putative developer for Pedley Farm, and we discussed, for instance, the size of trees that were to be planted. And we took 1/2 inch out of the caliper of the trees. It was a financial item, but more than that, the smaller trees are more survivable. And although this is not Headley Farms, our theory is that if we give on one site of the various ones in our plan, we give on all the sites. So that was one of the changes. There are a couple of other small ones. The one that immediately comes to mind is some of the buildings will look like, what I call them, raised ranches, you know, where you've got a walkout basement or a garage that goes right out to a driveway. And we had a long discussion about whether, say, a walkout basement counts as a story. And we decided it did not. So rather than having, a 10-foot-tall cinder block wall or a concrete block wall, we would have a garage door, and that space underneath the building would become usable.
Not adding any additional height?
Nope. The height remains
standard story.
35 feet?
Nope.
But the contour of the land would dictate that.
Right.
So.
Right. It was either that or you have a lot of retaining walls. And or
dirt moving.
Yeah. Or you grade up somehow. Yeah. And this seemed like a reasonable give, but when one looks at the buildings, if they were 3.5 stories, they're 3.5 stories now. And if one measures the buildings, if the height limit was 50, it's 50 now. So there were no give on those, but rather than have a fairly ugly-looking thing or, you know, either a big CMU wall or a big, you know, a retaining wall, we decided this made sense. And it's a fairly common. We were shown examples of a couple of other towns' regulations in this regard. So,
on one of these, now I can't find it, we gave control to the developer.
Only
the distribution of whether it's family.
We'll come to that. That's later on. And but this one is unchanged in that regard. We know what's going on. Any specific questions on it, or?
No, I have none.
No.
Okay. In that case, I'll make a motion.
I'll second it.
Mr. Kochanowski was at the mediation meeting. I should have mentioned.
Councilwoman Swetley.
Yes.
Councilman Kochanowski?
Yes.
Councilman
Millay?
Yes.
Council President
McTiernan?
Yes.
Yes. All right. The next one is, I'll address Mr. McTiernan's question. It's Ordinance 1121-18. It's an ordinance of the Township of Clinton, further amending Chapter 165 of the Code of the Township of Clinton by creating the AH-8 Affordable Housing Zoning District to facilitate an inclusionary affordable housing development on the Headley Farm Estate Tract, Block 46, Lots 33 and 33.01, and amending the Clinton Township zoning map and schedule of zoning requirements accordingly. So this is really, this particular development is what engendered that discussion. And again, 1/2 inch smaller caliper trees, the basement is not a story. And the mix of, it was always understood that the mix of dwelling units would be up to the developer. This is a 400-unit development. There's 104 affordable units, which, you know, are going to be built in a certain configuration. But there were a variety of other configurations, townhomes, multifamily, perhaps some single-family structures, perhaps some veterans housing. There was a bunch of different possibilities, and the putative developer would like flexibility, wanted the flexibility that we always had accorded them stated in the zoning. So if they want to build 20 or 30 townhouses or, you know, X number of single-family homes, not a big deal. It's a 155 or so acre tract. and as I say, 400 units, 296 market, 104 affordable. And this is a tough one from a economic viability perspective, and because they're probably going to have to provide their own utilities. So the more flexibility within parameters that we're comfortable with we could provide, the more likely this development would be to happen. So any discussion or questions? Or Brian, you look, you good?
I'm good.
All right. In that case, I'll make the motion to introduce.
I'll second it.
Councilwoman Sweatley?
Yes.
Councilman Kosmanowski?
Yes.
Councilman Miller?
Yes.
Council President McCarron?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the last one is Ordinance 1122-18, an ordinance by the Township of Clinton amending Chapter 165 of the Code of the Township of Clinton to revise the regulations applicable in the AH5 Affordable Housing District comprising a portion of the Marukian property on Route 31. This is a development that has already been accorded preliminary approval by the Planning Board, and so not all of the changes that I just discussed are incorporated into this. So,
and it's surrounded by open space.
Yeah, it's a six-acre development.
And setbacks don't necessarily apply as they might.
Well, that's a good point, Brian. It's the township years ago set aside 6 acres of the Marukian tract, which is 139 acres, and it was set aside and purchased with normal township funds for quote-unquote future public purposes. Well, the future public purpose is a 6-acre affordable housing, 100% affordable housing complex, and you know, honestly, we wish we had more acreage to fit 84 units in, but we don't. So since there are no adjacent neighbors, it's all preserved open land, we've allowed the setbacks to get very close to the property lines because those buildings are going to be a fairly, you know, permanent appurtenance to the township, and we're going to have taxpayers and voters and folks living in there. So we wanted to provide as much space within that 6 acres for greenswards, playground, community building, that sort of thing. So
I'll make a motion to introduce.
I'll second.
Go ahead.
Councilwoman Sweatler?
Yes.
Councilman Kosmanowski?
Yes.
Councilman Millay?
Yes.
Council President McCarron?
Yes.
Yes, and all these will be subject to a public hearing on September 12th. And I don't have any vouchers, but we have vouchers on the agenda. Yes.
Hey, they should have been handed out, yeah.
I certainly could have missed it in all the various emails, so my apologies. I don't think I saw it.
I didn't see them. No. Not in here? No. He gave them to you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Why don't we do public comment and we'll double back to the back.
There you go. All right. Mr. Millay says we are up to the second public comment period. Are there any members of the public? Here comes Les. Good evening.
Hi, Les Giese. I'm at 3 Windy Hill. Couple of things I just want to thank you for maybe moving forward on the deer and forest issues. I've been on the open space for several years, and having visited several of the properties, what the professor was talking about, a forest getting ready to implode, the Hackett's Preserve is within years of imploding. If you haven't gotten up there and looked at it to see the vines and whatnot coming over the forest. It's an unfortunate example of a forest getting ready to implode. So looking forward to moving along and trying to help the forest in the township. Second thing is I've been involved with the Rotary Club and the cross-country trail, the kiosks, the posts and whatnot. And Bill Babcock has been a tremendous help on it. I understand he was a former runner at North and pretty involved in the running sports, and he's been very helpful in helping me get some donations together and the posts. I'm hoping to get the posts and that in within 2 weeks. gave a heads up to Jesse and DPW. We've got about 20-some holes to dig.
That won't happen in 2 weeks.
Well,
just telling you.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But hopefully Labor Day we can maybe have stuff in the ground. So thank you very much.
And thank you for your work.
Yeah, great work.
Appreciate it.
Les.
Yes, it's good.
Thank you.
Besides everything else, Les is one of the founders of Hunters Helping the Hungry. And an avid, active hunter, and you know, a real presence on open space. He's a doer, as Amy and Jesse both know.
Yes.
So thank you for everything.
We try.
Thank you.
Yeah. Back to Belchers.
In that case,
is there anybody else?
Belchers.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I didn't see anybody moving. So okay.
And I will make a motion to approve the vouchers and pay the bills that I just reviewed.
I'll second that.
Yes.
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 Yes. Mr. Kochanowski, it's tradition that time of the
evening. I'll make a motion to adjourn.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Yes. I'll second it.
All right, we're even tonight. All those in favor? Opposed or abstaining? Silence. Thank you.